without partaking in pleasantries, cookies, or schnapps, Vinita and Connie took their leave. Outside the cottage, the moon was bright, and Connie's Horsch sport car gleamed like an object from another world. She detected the strong smell of winter thaw. The hay that had covered the vegetable garden all season was thick with mildew and hoarfrost, a trace of dead animal. But over this, the fresh, clean spring fragrance of the early blooming bloodroot and snow roses. And stepping through the door that Connie held open for her, Vinita could barely believe her good fortune.
"Two's a golden onion?"
he asked in a way that mocked the place and all its provincial pretensions, even as he suggested it.
"Of course,"
she smiled in keeping with his tone, as if they were not two strangers pursuing some staid courtship ritual in a small town in an obscure corner of the Reich, but rather sophisticated worldly lovers, known intimately to each other already, and playing a game of pretend. "Pretend we are two rubes in the backwaters of the Empire, meeting for the first time. Pretend we know nothing of who we are or where we are headed. Pretend the conclusion of this chance encounter has not already been foretold." Why had this faux familiarity been the starting point for them? It confused and flustered Vinita, but at the same time seemed essential, vital to the excitement. She would wonder about it later, when the time to wonder about such things returned. By then, Connie and old Frau Gruber were dead, and her brothers had been killed on the front, and there was no one left with any insight. At the Golden Onion, Vinita and Connie sat beside a pleasantly flickering fire, and Connie ordered them each a glass of the local cider and a schnitzel. It struck Vinita as comical, a fancy staff officer from Berlin ordering this.
"So, tell me," he asked when their cider was before them, and the Jäger schnitzel steamed greasily on its plate. "What do you really think of all this marching and saluting and repatriating the German peoples of Europe?"
Vinita was shocked at his question, the implication and glib tone. It was maybe a trick, she thought. After all, had he not said he was here on some official business? "I think it is a kindness by our Führer to bring them back into their motherland, and also the German people need more room and space." She parroted Fräulein Briebel in a confused rush.
"Who told you that?"
Connie asked, laughing.
"No one. It's what I think,"
Vinita said, drawing herself up straight.
"And what of all the opponents and communists and Jews who've been arrested?"
Vinita stared at him in disbelief. It was a traitorous line of questioning, and the basis for the question was fuzzy in her mind. Certainly, in Frelinghausen, no great number of people had been arrested. She stared down at her hands and could feel the blood racing to her cheeks.
"Oh, no. I have upset you."
"My dear maiden," Connie said, again using his cheerful play-acting voice,
"don't let my talk confuse you. Here, we'll talk about Frelinghausen's famous cider. Is it really as good as your arrogant distillers boast?"
He took a swig and made a comically evaluative face.
"Do they put socks in every barrel?"
"Only in the barrels they save for visitors like you."
Vinita recovered and was delighted to hear him laugh.
"Well, it's delicious,"
he pronounced, setting his glass on the table.
"In Berlin, we have only beer."
He made a face.
"And champagne," she said. "Isn't it so? There are bars in Berlin where they serve nothing but champagne?"
"Absolutely."
Connie leaned forward and took her hand. A thrill raced through her at the touch.
"Will you come to one with me, Mademoiselle Gruber?"
"You are an odd one,"
Vinita could not help exclaiming, and for a moment she worried that she had ruined their game. Connie threw back his head and laughed.
"I am sure you are right, Fräulein. and you must promise to remind me of that whenever I am being a bore.
The rest of the evening passed pleasantly. There was no further talk of politics, and Connie seemed truly interested in learning all about her. Benita had never been asked so many questions, about her family, her childhood, her town, and Fräulein Briebel's BDM group, about which Connie was remarkably curious. The cider made her feel free and light, and through Connie's eyes she saw herself anew. Not only was she beautiful and young, a future bearer of bold and strong Aryan children, but she was also a woman who could tell funny stories. And her life, the boring small-town monotony of Frühlinghausen, had become a subject worthy of this man's attention. The carnival at which she was crowned queen last year, the crabby town butcher who mixed up everyone's orders, the time Frau Meltzer's pigs escaped onto the mental hospital grounds. Connie had a seemingly bottomless appetite for her tales. And every time his knee grazed hers, she felt a jolt of electricity. When they reached Seven Krenzig, the windows were dark. Frau Gruber was not one to stay awake past 10, even on such an occasion. Connie ran around to Benita's side of the car and held her door as she climbed out. Then, as she stood there against the still warm body of his car, he leaned down and kissed her, lightly and skillfully, one hand tilting her chin. It was entirely different from Herbert Schmidt's rough advances, or Thorsten Finkenberg's awkward kisses, and she felt her whole body thrill at the feel of his smooth-shaven chin and the height from which he approached. She leaned into the spicy clove scent of his aftershave and the pressed wool of his suit. "Can I see you again?" he asked. "I leave tomorrow, but if you say yes, I will come back in 2 weeks."
"Yes," she said,
leaving aside strategy and coyness.
"Then it is decided," he said, "and I will wait until you are safely inside."
With that, Benita made her way up the narrow path and into the ugly, comfortable squalor of her childhood home, forever changed. She was a maiden who had met her prince. Chapter 4. Burg Lingenfels, June 1945. The little boy sitting on the counter in front of Marianne was a miniature version of his father. Same startling blue eyes, high cheekbones, and straight, elegant features. His demeanor was different, though, certainly from that of his father as a man, but also from what he had been like as a boy. This Martin was solemn, impassive, and self-controlled, where that Martin had been exuberant, bright, and spontaneous. This Martin's face was a closed door. God knows it had good reason to be. Marianne would never forget her first sight of him, peering wan-faced out the window of that awful Nazi orphanage.
"Does this hurt?"
Marianne asked as she straightened the battered leg they had come inside to repair.
"No," he shook his head.
"Or this?"
He shook his head again, but this time he flinched.
"Well, then, we will wash it and bandage it, and it will be as good as new."
Marianne dipped a rag into a bowl of water and then pressed it against the bloody gash. She could feel the grit in his broken flesh. But the boy did not cry. It was a bad fall. He and Fritz had been playing some sort of game in the rafters of the old horse stable. Fritz's idea, of course. Her son could not stay out of trouble. It was as if all the hasty actions, zany ideas, and ill-considered nonsense he'd suppressed during their stressful journey west from Weislau had returned to him doubled. Where had he come by his incautious streak? Neither she nor Albrecht had been impulsive or disorganized as a child. Even Elisabeth, for all her willfulness, was at least careful.
Luckily, the floor of the stable was still the original packed earth. And Martin had landed like a cat. He seemed to have inherited the gift of luck from his father, who'd always had it in spades, until he didn't.
"You know not to play on those beams now," Marianne said. "I think we need not concern your mother with this as long as you promise to be more careful. And,"
she raised her eyebrows,
"promise not to let Fritz get you into trouble. He can be a real gypsy."
"I won't,"
Martin said, his voice earnest and childlike. She forgot just how young he was sometimes.
"I promise."
Martin was not easily brought to tears. She had seen this much when he said goodbye to the little girl from the children's home, Liesel Stravitsky. It was obvious he had loved her. But when they found her family, such as it was, a beleaguered aunt with three small children, her father dead, her mother last known to be in Auschwitz, Marianne's own eyes had not stayed dry. The poor girl had thrown her arms around Martin and bawled as if her little heart would break. But he had remained stoic. Marianne tied the last strip of silk around the cut.
"Why don't you sit in the kitchen and help Elisabeth and Katerina shell the peas?"
Martin opened his mouth as if to speak.
"What is it?"
she asked, placing a hand on his other, unhurt and chasteningly bony knee.
"When will I be able to see her?"
he asked.
"My mother."
"Soon,"
Marianne said.
"I promise."
Benita had fallen sick with diphtheria a week after arriving at Berg Lingenfels. They said this was what happened sometimes. As soon as one made it to safety, illness set in. Marianne and her children had been inoculated at the English hospital in Braunschweig. As the wife and children of Albrecht von Lingenfels, they were classified as Opfer des Faschismus, victims of fascism, and treated well by the British authorities, who had waved their cart past the long line of fellow refugees queued at the border between zones. They were a wretched lot, mostly old people, women and children fleeing from the East. It made Marianne feel guilty. What right to special treatment did she and her children have? They were lucky enough to have a wagon and a horse to pull it. Benita, on the other hand, had received none of these advantages. She had not advocated for herself as the widow of Conny Fledermann, an active resistor and a man executed by the Nazis. Though, to be fair, it was different in Russian-occupied Berlin. A German was a German to most Russians. So she was simply a German widow, and a beautiful one at that, which had not worked to her benefit. Marianne would never forget the leering soldiers around the table in the flat on Miersteinstrasse, or the horrible little bedroom with the closed windows and stink of sex. She had arrived too late. She had promised Connie that she would protect his wife and child, and she had failed. Once Martin was safely settled in the kitchen, Marianne washed the bloody rags that had once been Elisabeth's communion dress. This had arrived last week in a giant sea trunk that was delivered, improbably, on the back of an American Army mail truck. Her heart twisted when she saw the trunk. Albrecht had insisted, years ago, that they pack it up and send it to his cousins in Geneva for safekeeping. A gift from a four-sided dead man.
"We live in the middle of nowhere, Albrecht,"
Marianne had complained when he suggested packing up their prized possessions.
"It's not as if any army will bother with Weislau." But Albrecht was right.
The Russians had marched right through the town, determined to avenge their losses, taking everything from bicycles to grandfather clocks to Grossmutter von Lingenfels' maudlin needlepoints. Collateral for the toll the war had exacted, as if loot could bring back their dead.
"You finally have your way with all of it, Fräulein Communist,"
Marianne imagined Albrecht saying at the sight of the shredded communion dress. It was their little joke. She had liked to proclaim fancy clothing and fine table settings bourgeois banalities, distractions from the real fineries of human life. Music and poetry, theater and art. Which was itself a foolish bourgeois statement. The war had made this clear. Music, poetry, and art were luxuries, too. Everything was a distraction from the basic struggle between life and death. What Albrecht had not understood, though, when he packed their trunk, was that the culture that had given birth to these precious objects and endowed them with value would be so thoroughly self-immolated that its assignations were no longer valid. What was the point of a Chinese silk pinafore sewn by Weislau's finest tailor when you didn't even have a pair of shoes? Or a Meissen China tea service transported without so much as one chipped plate, when there was no tea, no bread, no table to eat at? He had anticipated disaster, but not lived to see its depths.
Mama!
The washroom door flew open, and Katerina appeared.
The American leader is here!
The American leader was how the children referred to Lieutenant Peterman, the man in charge of rebuilding Erenheim and its surrounding area. He had been kind to the von Lingenfelses since their arrival, and he treated Marianne with a certain nervous respect, based on his belief that she was descended from royalty, she was not, and that her husband had been a friend of the American General Patton. A vast exaggeration, as Albrecht had never even met the man. Marianne had not planted either of these ideas, but she didn't go out of her way to correct them. Peterman was a useful ally. She had enlisted his help in her search for fellow widows of resistors, the women and children she had sworn so passionately to protect at the Countess's long-ago harvest party.
"The commander of wives and children,"
Connie had called her. The words had seemed demeaning to her at the time, an exclusion from the real business of conspiring, a reminder that she was, in the end, a woman, and therefore relegated to the work of picking up the pieces. But in the years since, she had come to understand his words differently. She was the last man standing, the decoy left holding the key. Though what she was supposed to do with it remained opaque. At the very least, she could honor her promise and do her best to look out for the wives of the men present in the room that night.
"Frau von Lingenfels!"
Peterman barked in his jocular way. On his lips, von Lingenfels always sounded comical to her ears, the G hard and the syllables flat.
"Lieutenant?"
Marianne replied. Behind Peterman she noticed another man, tall, thin, and wearing a ragged Wehrmacht uniform with the insignias removed. He stared down at his boots. A German prisoner of war. There were thousands of these in the British and American internment camps.
"Have you found one of my Fraus?"
Marianne asked Peterman lightly. It was the same joke he had made when she gave him her list of names. "So look for any of these names with Frau in front?" he'd asked. "I'm afraid not," Peterman said. A shadow swept over his face. Clearly he had not given the list a thought. "But I've brought you someone to help out around the castle." Marianne looked from Peterman to the other man, who met her eyes for an instant. His own were a pale, almost transparent shade of blue. And he had a broad, unexpectedly handsome face. "Herr Müller is one of the detainees from our camp, and I figure you could probably use an extra set of hands around here. Müller is handy, worked on a farm before the war, right?" he asked, turning to the man. "Bauernhof?" The man looked from Peterman to Marianne questioningly. He was not a farmer, Marianne understood.
"That's all right," she frowned.
Marianne did not like the idea of relying on an ex-Nazi prisoner of the Americans for help. God knows what sort of person he was, what sort of soldier he had been.
And on top of this,
he was her countryman.
You don't need any help.
I beg your pardon, Frau von Lingenfels, but... Petermann stepped back and surveyed the castle edifice. You have broken windows up there and missing slates. And, he looked at her, winter is coming. You'll need wood. Petermann turned to the man again and pantomimed an axe. You can chop wood. Holtz, right? The man nodded in assent. So? Petermann asked, squinting at Marianne. Will that suit? I'd hate to have you freeze up here, especially with so many trees around.
Marianne sighed. You make it hard to say no.
All right, Petermann said. Next Thursday, then. You have an axe?
Dinner that night was their usual nearly unpalatable meal of soup. Marianne had never learned to cook. As a girl, she had been spoiled, the bright and favorite daughter of a wealthy widower who believed in women's education over domesticity. She had read Goethe and Schopenhauer and Schiller, rather than cookbooks.
We are going to have a slave here, in our house, once a week?
Elisabeth demanded.
Oh, stop it! Certainly not a slave! Marianne snapped. Why would you say such a thing? Well, he is,
Elisabeth harumphed.
That's what prisoners of war are. I heard Herr Koffel say so. Slave labor. Against international regulations. How is that different from what we did when we were in charge?
We, Marianne echoed, appalled. We were never Nazis. Don't forget that.
Elisabeth shrugged.
Still, he won't be getting paid for his work.
Right now, if you hadn't noticed, Marianne said, no one is getting paid for their work. And certainly coming here to cut down trees once a week will be a pleasant relief from the internment camp, which seems to be an impossible place.
There were rumors of men dying in such installations. Barren fields with no shelter and no shade from the sun. Of men sleeping in holes they dug out. Though Marianne did not trust most rumors the Ehrenheimers circulated. She turned to her son.
Fritz, sit like a man and stop fidgeting. Did he kill many people in the war?
Katerina asked in a hushed voice.
Is that why he is a prisoner?
Marianne looked at this daughter. Dark-haired, plain-faced, and thoughtful. Always slow and deliberate in her reactions.
So much like Albrecht. I don't know, love,
she sighed.
Lots of people are prisoners. Even boys your own age who don't know one end of a rifle from the other. I don't know what Herr Müller did.
Something bad anyway,
Elisabeth grumbled.
Oh, Elisabeth, really?
Marianne snapped.
I didn't ask for his help, but now we have it. He will cut wood to help us get through the winter, and for that you should be thankful.
In the silence that followed, she mulled over her own words.
Is that how it works?
She could hear Albrecht asking.
Personal gain trumps moral decision.
Yes.
No. What was the difference between the man working here at the castle or for the Americans? Either way, he was a prisoner.
Connie would have supported her view, wouldn't he?
She doled out the last of the soup.
Probably he had a Luger anyway,
Fritz offered.
Do you think he still has it?
No,
Marianne said firmly.
No Germans can carry arms. Now, could we sit and eat our supper in peace?
She turned to Martin, who had remained quiet through all of this.
Wouldn't that be nice?
After dinner, Marianne climbed the stairs to see Benita. She had moved her to a cot in the warren of servants' rooms above the kitchen, where they all slept. These were the best rooms in the castle now.
During the cold months, they would be warmed by the fire from the giant oven below. The formerly grand bedroom suites at the front of the castle were chilly and dim, littered with the hacked-up remains of ancient curtained beds. Marianne had been appalled to discover this when she arrived. Who would have chopped apart such antiques? In the great hall, too, the grand piano was mangled, its keyboard stripped of ivory, its wires splayed like a giant spider. Possibly the Nazis had done this. For a short time, before the end of the war, an SS unit had taken up residence in Berglingenfels. One corner of the courtyard was still stacked with their empty tins of meat and cherries and white asparagus. But it was also possible that the citizens of Erenheim were responsible for the destruction. In the last days of war, after the Nazis had left, many of the townspeople had holed up in the empty castle to hide from the approaching Americans, who they believed would rape and murder them. And Marianne would not put such destruction past the Erenheimers. They were an insular bunch, all married to one another's cousins and uncles and brothers, and locked into the mindset of medieval serfdom in which the castle folk were their oppressors. They had all been ardent Nazis, as far as she could tell. And to them, Marianne and her children were the family of a traitor, a man who had tried to kill their beloved Führer, in addition to being born von Lingenfels. Marianne paused and reached into her pocket for the letter she was delivering. It felt cool and soft with wear, and sent a rush of adrenaline through her. She rapped lightly on Benita's door. Lying in the narrow army cot Marianne had arranged, Benita no longer appeared the rosy German peasant Mädchen she had once been. Marianne had chopped her blonde hair to help protect her from germs. And shorn like this, Benita looked thin and world-weary, her full cheeks hollowed, the color of paper, and her eyes huge and dark. She was still beautiful, but now in a painful, trampled way. Marianne placed the tray of broth and water beside the bed, and Benita's eyes fluttered open. "Is Martin all right?" she asked, and immediately began to cough. "Shh." Marianne raised a finger to her lips. "He's fine. He and Fritz have been up to all sorts of healthy little boy things." "He isn't..." Benita began, but was again interrupted by her cough. "He isn't sick. Perfectly healthy," Marianne said. She did not mention the fall. Benita nodded, but her eyes remained anxious. Before the war, Marianne had imagined that Benita would become mother to a horde of children, a robust and placid matriarch. Connie had always wanted a big family, 5 or 6 children at least, a different experience from his own as an only child. What had happened in the meantime? Miscarriages? Infertility? Connie had never confided in Marianne about his marriage, and she wasn't close enough to Benita for her to do so. How ironic that she, bony, flat-chested Marianne, would be the more fertile of the two women. Marianne sat on the edge of the cot and lifted a spoonful of broth to Benita's lips, the last of the bouillon they had smuggled out of Weislau. Dutifully, Benita opened her mouth. As Marianne leaned in to spoon the soup, the letter crinkled. It was time, certainly, to give it to her. But it was so difficult to part with. Connie had left it with her the last time she saw him. "To my wife, Benita Fledermann," was written on the envelope in his long, thin script. Surprisingly elegant for a man's. She was supposed to give it to Benita in the event of his death. And this time, when he'd enlisted her help, Marianne had not protested. But when the plot failed and Connie died, Marianne found she could not deliver the letter. It was too dangerous with Albrecht in prison. 6 months passed between the assassination attempt and Albrecht's trial and hanging.
and Marianne had spent those months pleading for his release. Visiting high-powered contacts, writing letters, and even on three occasions being interrogated by the Gestapo. Her possession of a letter from Connie Fledermann would not have helped matters. And then afterward, when Albrecht was dead, it was impossible to gain access to Benita, who was sequestered in a Nazi prison. So she had held on to the letter the entire journey back from Berlin, waiting for the right moment, which never seemed to come.
"I have something for you,"
she made herself say after Benita swallowed the last spoonful of broth. Benita lifted her eyes. Marianne pulled out the letter. It was dirty and crumpled, but it had survived. The Russians, the flight from Wieslau, the end of the war. To her surprise, Benita did not startle at the sight of her husband's handwriting. She did not even move to take the letter from Marianne's hand.
"I've had this for too long," Marianne began. "I'm sorry. I didn't know how to get it to you. And when we were on our way from Berlin, it seemed that you should have a quiet place to read it."
Still, Benita said nothing. From outside, Marianne could hear the sound of the children playing.
"I didn't even know, you know,"
Benita said finally, looking up.
"Know what?"
Marianne asked.
"What they were planning."
"They told almost no one, but they told you." Benita's tone was startlingly fierce. Marianne searched the girl's pale face. It was both hard and hurt, tinged with petulance. For a moment she felt the full weight of Connie's words to her that night after the party. "She is a simple girl, and she won't deserve whatever mess I might drag her into."
"It was different," Marianne sighed. "I was a part of their conversations. If I were a man, the Nazis would have hanged me, too."
She paused, considering. It was the first time she had spoken this aloud. Benita looked away. Between them, the letter lay where Marianne had placed it. She felt its presence like a living thing, like a child or an animal, waiting to be held.
"How did you—"
Benita began, and then dissolved into a fit of coughing.
"How did you keep them from taking your children, and from sending you to prison?" "I don't know,"
Marianne said, though in truth she could guess. The Nazis had never liked Connie, whereas Albrecht had maintained the frustrated respect of a few among them, until the very end. Through his natural diplomacy, maybe. Or, more likely, on account of his deeper and more illustrious roots. Connie was from an old, once-rich Junker family. But Albrecht was a von Lingenfels, descended from a long line of revered German generals, a vital stem of Hitler's beloved master race.
"We were lucky."
"Ah," Benita said. "And we were not." Finally, she picked up the letter. But the look in her eyes was neither sad nor loving. She regarded the envelope in her hands like an object from outer space.
"Here,"
Marianne said, gathering the soup bowl and spoon.
"I will leave you to read in peace."
Benita nodded. But as Marianne closed the door, she saw Benita set the letter down unopened and lie back, flat as a corpse. Marianne had spent a good amount of time considering Connie's marriage. After his wedding, she had seen him together with Benita from time to time, at the Bimmelmann's Christmas party, at a few dinners she had hosted in Berlin, and once at a weekend gathering in Wieslau. It was a difficult match. The girl was quick to seem aggrieved. Connie had not fetched her from the station, or the baby was not sleeping, or no one had helped her with her suitcases on the train. And Connie was over-solicitous.
But even though he was attentive, he remained somehow apart from his wife, disconnected from her in a way that seemed to encourage her complaints. Marianne did not understand what had drawn him to Benita to begin with. She did not normally consider such matters, but this was not just any marriage. Benita was Connie Fledermann's wife. She was beautiful, to be sure, but he had beautiful women all over Germany who fancied themselves in love with him. There was an innocence about her, an inherent lack of wit and sophistication that no amount of money or time in the city could transform, which was endearing in a certain way. But Marianne had never known Connie to be enthralled by this sort of simplicity. It was the Nazis who revered such quaint, unthinking Volkishness, not forward-thinking men of the world like Connie. Yet Benita had captivated him. Marianne had come across them once, alone on the terrace of a mansion in Dahlem, at a party thrown by one of Albrecht's colleagues. It was in the first years of the war, when there was still plenty of wine and gaiety to go around. She had hesitated in the doorway, and something about their demeanor made her stop before calling out. Benita was smiling up at Connie coyly, and was without little Martin, which was rare in those days. Connie's back was to Marianne. As she watched, Benita said something that made him laugh, a real head-thrown-back burst of astonishment. And then he caught her around the waist and pulled her toward him with an intensity that made Marianne catch her breath. It was forceful, even aggressive, a side of Connie she had never seen. Benita returned his laughter and allowed herself to be wholly enveloped in his embrace, with a kind of softness and subservience that Marianne couldn't imagine emulating. This was the closest she had come to understanding Connie's marriage. Benita made him a looser, more animal version of himself. Marianne had felt a stab of sadness at the realization and hastily retreated into the familiar comforts of the party and the various like-minded people with whom she knew how to converse. But she was like a person masquerading at normalcy after receiving terrible news. And when Marianne found Albrecht, dear, steady Albrecht with his soft eyes and stooped shoulders, his thoughtful, deliberate way of speaking, she felt lonely and irritated by the crumb caught on his cheek, the dandruff on his evening jacket. And the fact that he stepped back to make room for her, rather than pulling her close. Chapter 5. Weislau, July 20th, 1944. For Marianne, the 20th of July had unfolded slowly. It was hot in Weislau. The children mooned around in the late Großmutter von Lingenfels's parlor, a cave of faded tapestries and heavily shaded lamps. They loved to lounge on the horsehair sofa in their light summer clothes, sucking penny candies and leafing idly through the collection of ancient illustrated books. Greek myths, Bible stories, German folk tales, and obscure scientific tomes. And Fritz spent an unseemly amount of time examining prudish drawings of the human body in a great Victorian medical encyclopedia. Großmutter would have been appalled. Their activities in the parlor always struck Marianne as slothful and vaguely debauched. On this day, the children were sorting a pile of scrap metal they had collected, valuables they planned to turn in to the local Nazi district head as their small contribution to the war effort. Marianne had no patience for such Nazi nonsense, especially when it involved turning her children into little warmongers. She had managed to keep them out of the youth groups, despite Fritz's wheedling. He hated to be excluded from the local Hitlerjugend Sunday hikes and football matches. But even so, they were caught up in the obsessions of their peers. Collecting scrap metal seemed particularly idiotic to Marianne, and it always led to squabbles,
who had found what, and how much they would get in exchange.
As if any of them really needed pocket money. They were lucky out here in Vaislau. On the land, with their own source of food and no bombs to worry about. This was the fifth year of the war, and in the cities it was ugly now. There, children needed all sorts of things. Safety, a roof over their heads, enough to eat, and coal to burn in their furnaces through the winter.
It had been nearly a year since the bombing of Hamburg, yet the stories and images of the aftermath were still grim. The newspapers ran tales of orphaned children living in the city's remains, surviving on rats and fetid water, of people who had boiled to death in the canals as they tried to escape the firestorm.
It was difficult, of course, to discern truth from propaganda, and Marianne trusted nothing the Nazi press printed. But still, the photographs were shocking. The inner city transformed into a gray and cratered landscape like the surface of the moon. And she had seen firsthand the faces of those who had fled to find work and housing in the south. They were blank with shock.
On this particular afternoon, Marianne could not tolerate the children's bickering. All night, all week, really, she was held in suspense. Any day now, the plan was to unfold.
Uncle Ulrich would join us next weekend.
Albrecht's latest telegram from Berlin had read,
"Please prepare his favorite Semmelkuchen."
They had decided on the code words together. Since then, sleep had been a delicate web she was too big and too clumsy to be caught in. She clutched at strands of it like a falling woman. And despite the months and years of preparation, the arguments and discussions, what justifies a murder? Can right be achieved through wrong? And despite the endless how and when and where, and most endlessly of all, what comes next? It seemed incredible, impossible even, that their plot would unfold at last. Albrecht had not approved at first. Assassination. Murder. It was not the culmination he wanted for the resistance movement. In his estimation, injustice could be fought only with justice. He was a lawyer to the core. Murder was evil. This was an absolute.
But if it would end the war and prevent the murder of thousands, even millions?
They had debated this often, deep into the night with him probing his own convictions, and Marianne playing devil's advocate. Although, in fact, she was not the devil's advocate. She believed Connie and von Stauffenberg and the others were right. Hitler must be killed. For her, the case was sealed 3 years before, when Freddy Lederer returned from the east. He had stopped at Wieslau on his journey from the general government zone of occupied Poland. And Freddy, an open-hearted boy Marianne had known since childhood, always the first to jump off the dock at the lake, and the last to come in for dinner at the Grand Hotel on the Ostsee, had been a gaunt shell of himself. He had recently returned from an intelligence trip for the Abwehr, and they had assigned him an SS escort, who had taken him to see an action,
a miracle of efficiency and dedication,
as this SS man described it. The action was being carried out by a unit of ordinary German reservists. Older men for the most part, civilians with little or no training or military background. They had been instructed to cleanse the area south of Lublin. Lublin. Freddy had shuddered pronouncing the name.
A kind of hell on earth.
They were rounding up Jewish women, children, and old men, and marching them into the forest to be shot.
To be shot?
Marianne repeated.
Are you certain?
She had heard rumors, of course, but had still believed, though not supported, the Nazis' Madagascar plan. All Polish Jews would be shipped to that island to form their own homeland. Other, darker stories trickled back from the front, but she had dismissed them as rumor or exaggeration. This was different, though. This was straight from the mouth of Freddy Lederer. And he had seen it with his own eyes. German soldiers paired one to one. Victims and their killers marched into the woods as partners. Children had been assigned their own executioners. He had watched one woman with three children, a little one unable to walk yet, an older boy and a little girl, maybe 7 or 8 years old. The girl had refused to let go of her mother's hand, so she had been allowed to walk together with her and the baby, a tiny thing, wrapped carefully in blankets, looking around with wide eyes.
"That one will make trouble,"
Freddy's escort had said with indifference.
"Three shots for one soldier. It will slow the process down."
When Freddy finished speaking, silence welled up around them in the comfortable library of Weisslau, with its roaring fire and plush furniture, its dog snoring lazily on the hearth. Marianne sat frozen with a kind of stillness that aimed to stop time, to go back, to untell Freddy's story.
"For the longest time," Freddy said, "I could not grasp what I was looking at. I saw it, but I couldn't take it in. It was..."
He groped for an analogy, his pale face haggard with the effort.
"It was like one of those hidden pictures. You see a goblet, not a face. A stairway, not a flower. You can't see it even when it's right there in front of you. And then, suddenly..."
He raised his eyes and looked directly at Marianne.
"You do."
Marianne dreamed of them that night. The mothers and children walking into the woods. And the men, her own neighbors and peers, her fellow countrymen, marching them. This was what all Hitler's frightening rants amounted to. Ordinary, middle-aged men marching mothers and children into forests to be killed. For so long, Marianne and Albrecht and many of their friends had known Hitler was a lunatic, a leader whose lowbrow appeal to people's most selfish, self-pitying emotions and ignorance was an embarrassment for their country. They had watched him make a masterwork of scapegoating Jews for Germany's fall from power, and persuade his followers that enlightenment, humanity, and tolerance were weaknesses, Jewish ideas that led to defeat. They had wrung their hands over his dangerous conflations, his fervor and his lack of humanity. But Freddy Lederer's account was something new to Marianne. She lay in bed that night and knew Connie was right. Hitler must die. For Albrecht, though, the answer still lay in the pursuit of justice. He, too, was deeply affected by Freddy's report. He redoubled his efforts to assist Jews in their attempts to escape, and to bring Nazi horrors like the one Freddy described to the attention of the British and the Americans, who he believed were the only hope for defeating Hitler. He was a religious person, much more so than Marianne, and he grappled with his faith. He lost sleep and barely ate, but he still believed the answer was to judge the man in the court of law.
"Only when we prove that international law and the human rights of all mankind are greater than any villain can we vanquish evil."
He remained steadfast in this belief.
"But this is impossible, Albrecht," Marianne argued. "How are you to bring Hitler to a court of law? All of Germany would have to rise up against him."
"It's the support of the outside world," he would say, "and with time." He was a dreamer, though, Marianne felt. There was no time, and all of Germany would never rise up. They were too steeped in Hitler's rhetoric, too cowardly, too implicated in the horrors of his war to reject him. 2 weeks after his visit to Weisslau, Freddy hanged himself. It was not until the news of the extermination camps reached Albrecht. Not the rumors, but the undeniable first-hand accounts he had access to through his work in the Abwehr, that he agreed. Assassination was the only way. Downstairs. Marianne sank into the cool leather of the chair at her husband's desk, with the intention of going through their accounts. She had taken over the bookkeeping when Albrecht's work in government, and more important, in the resistance, became too demanding. Sitting here, at this great desk where he had drawn up many plans and documents, Marianne was struck, as if for the first time, by the possibility that their plot might fail. Outside the window, she caught a flash of black flapping across the lawn, followed by a brown-gray blur, which resolved itself into a cat chasing a crow. As she watched, the cat managed to bring one outstretched paw down on the bird's wing. The crow half flew, half jumped forward, wing crooked at an alarming angle, and the cat, satisfied with the damage, turned and streaked back into the bushes. The bird staggered and flapped. It began to utter a throaty, guttural sound. Three other crows flew down from the treetops and stood at a respectful distance, watching, heads cocked, as it hobbled before them with its terrible trailing wing spread out as evidence. Then, as if they'd passed judgment and found their comrade beyond hope, they flew away. The sight was at once horrifying and addictive. Marianne could not avert her eyes. It was just the two of them now, though the crow did not know she watched. She stood frozen at the window with a hard, knotted feeling in her chest. If the cat returned, she would open the window and shoo it away, or go outside and throw a rock. But it didn't. It was content to leave the bird to die. Marianne was not a believer in signs and portents. These were the recourse of the powerless. But all the same, in that instant, she had the clearest sense the coup had failed. "In the end, it will hang on chance," Albrecht had said when she last saw him. She had nodded, but had not understood it in her heart. She had never really allowed herself to consider the opposite of success. She had believed, almost superstitiously, that to admit doubt would invite failure, and to imagine success would bring it about. And her imagination was docile. It conjured what she told it to. No more, no less. She did not imagine crevasses and hidden boulders when the children skied. She did not picture an accident when Albrecht drove too fast. It was part of what made her confident rather than anxious. It was part of what made her an optimist. She had pushed Albrecht to support the plan and championed taking action almost from the start. Inaction was impossible. Once you knew, really knew, of the women and children being shot in the woods, of the shower rooms constructed for the sole purpose of killing, how could you not act? But now, here was the obvious reason she had repressed. The cost. If the plan failed, all that she cherished would be lost. Somehow, Marianne managed to get through the afternoon, a blind woman fumbling her way down a familiar path. She filled out the ledger with the number of pigs born in the last month and the bushels of wheat harvested. She presided over tea. If the conspirators were intercepted, what would happen? Arrest? Imprisonment? Death? Albrecht's connection would surely be discovered. How could it not? He had hosted the plan's primary actors on many occasions, and was a known critic of the Nazis. Of course, they had been careful. Last month, they had burned letters and buried notebooks and plans. Even the guest book of Weisslau had been lost. But there were countless threads to implicate him. Meanwhile, outside, the crow staggered around in the dark margin of shadow between the woods and the lawn. Its wing dragged, its shiny eye blinked. She did not want the children to see it. "Don't look. Don't look," she told herself. But her eyes were helplessly drawn to where it hunched, damaged wing extended like a cape. Before supper, Frau Gerstler, the cook, entered the study with a stricken look on her face.
Our Führer has been injured. Our dear Führer, assassins have made an attempt on his life. But praise God, he has only been hurt.
Marianne clutched the arms of the chair to steady herself. It was less a shock than a confirmation.
Our Führer, our Führer,
Frau Gerstler cried.
Thank God he has survived.
Almost as if he were her own son or husband.
What is it? What happened?
The children clamored around her, drawn by instinct from wherever they had been playing.
Frau Gerstler has heard rumors,
Marianne said, amazed she was able to speak.
The Führer,
Fritz persisted.
Did she say he was almost killed?
Don't eavesdrop on adult conversation,
Marianne snapped, drawing courage from the sound of her own voice.
Frau Gerstler,
Marianne said when the children retreated in confusion.
I would appreciate it if you kept such rumors out of our house.
But, madam,
Frau Gerstler said,
it is on the radio.
After that, there was no possible excuse for turning off the radio. Hitler himself was expected at any moment to give a speech. The urgency forced Marianne to calm the storm inside her head. She had to be careful. From now on, every movement she made would be suspect. Frau Gerstler loved the family, but she did not love them so much that she wouldn't inform on them if the Gestapo asked. So they listened to the broadcast as a group. Frau Gerstler at their center, wringing her hands and shaking her head. Fritz, too, could barely contain himself, his eyes bright with anger and astonishment. But Marianne was too distracted to be rattled by her son's ignorance. The girls listened with less fervor. Elisabeth rolled her eyes at the hysterical tone of the announcer behind Frau Gerstler's back. Katharina sat quietly beside her mother, looking up from time to time with wide, perceptive eyes, trying to read her face. When Hitler spoke, his voice was as absurd as always, but this time tinged with a special bellicose fury.
The claim by these usurpers that I am no longer alive is at this very moment proven false. For here I am, talking to you, my dear fellow countrymen. The circle which these usurpers represent is very small. It has nothing to do with the German armed forces, and above all, nothing to do with the German army. It is a very small clique composed of criminal elements, which will now be mercilessly exterminated.
The word exterminate repeated itself in Marianne's ears. There would be executions, certainly. Klaus von Stauffenberg, Ludwig Beck, and Connie. Connie. There was no way he could escape. He was too central to the plot. She held her hands together in her lap so no one could see them shake. But what of Albrecht? What of the children and Weislau? What of herself? She had to remain calm and think straight. Albrecht had many powerful friends, even among Hitler's regime. It was possible this would help, and she had heard nothing from him yet. So she would need, first of all, to wait. They had discussed what she should do in the case of his arrest. But until she had confirmation, she must carry on as normal. Somehow, she managed to get the children to bed that night. Then, unable to help herself, she looked out the window for the crow in the semi-dark. The sun sank late this time of year. It was nearly 10, and still the meadow glowed. The patch of woods beyond was enveloped in black. At the edge, a form distinguished itself. Still broken, still hobbling, no better, no worse. Marianne pulled on her boots and jacket and quietly let herself out. There it was. As the door closed, the crow stopped. Her eyes adjusted to the dark.